I'm going to call the Public Safety Finance Division to order. We have one item of business today, and that is to deal with a funding issue that we have here in the state of Minnesota regarding CHIPS cases or child in need of protective services. And we have the Judicial Council approved a working group in 2008 to explore this issue. As you know, because of budget cuts, Public Defense has decided that they cannot represent all parties in CHIPS petitions and has created a problem for our court system as well as our counties. So the working group was created by the Judicial Council, and we're pleased to have the Honorable Helen Myers is the Associate Justice with Minnesota Supreme Court here, and also I believe she has a staff attorney with her that will, I'd ask her if she could give a brief historical overview of the problem and then talk in more detail about what the working group study did, what it investigated, and what its recommendations to this committee are. So, Judge, if you would mind... Judge, if you could introduce yourself for the record, please.
Yes, good morning. My name is Helen Meyer, Associate Justice of the Minnesota Supreme Court. And seated with me today is Judy Nord, Staff Attorney for State Court Administration. I also have Attorney Jim Backstrom here from my group who will join me to present our report. And I just want to say thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Judge. Thank you for being here, and we look forward to your presentation.
Let me tell you how we'd like to go about telling you about the problem and what we think the solution is. To begin with, we just want to give the committee a brief overview of the law in the area of the acronym is CHIPS and TPR. So Children in Need of Protective Services and Termination of Parental Rights. In the area of CHIPS and TPR, there is a body of federal law and state law and a significant body of court rules. And to give you that overview, I'm just going to ask that Judy Nord introduce herself and then give you maybe 10 minutes on that. And we also want to talk about the statutory issues that come into play here when we talk about parent representation and funding for that mandate. So, with permission.
Okay, just a couple items here. Members, please, and people in the audience, if you turn your cell phones off, it's interrupting the sound system in this meeting room. And also, I believe we have a quorum now, so we'll just take care of that business. I'll need a motion to approve the minutes of January 15th and January 21st that are in your folders. Representative Liebring makes that motion. Is there any questions or corrections on the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay, so Ms. Nord, you're up. Can you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Thank you. Good morning, Representative Paymar, Representative. My name is Judy Nord, and I'm a staff attorney with the State Court Administrator's Office and manager of the Children's Justice Initiative. As Justice Meyer stated this morning, I'm going to be presenting a quick overview of the child protection process, and then talking a little bit about the statutes that are implicated by this process and some of the tension between the statutes. I'll start by referring to one document that I think is at your table, and at the top it's labeled 2007 Child Protection Statistics. I think you should all have a copy of that. And then there's a second document that looks more like a flow chart that I'll be referencing, and hopefully you all have a copy of that. But I'll start with the document that says 2007 statistics at the top. And I put that together to give you a little bit of a foundation for the number and the depth and breadth and degree of these cases that we have in the state of Minnesota. As you can see, and these are statistics from 2007. There are some statistics for 2008, but they're not complete, so I thought I would go with the stats that are for a full year. For 2007, there were 18,348 reports of abuse and neglect across the state, which, when one thinks about it, that's a significant number of reports of abuse. And those involved 26,561 children. The way the Department of Human Services investigates those is using two different processes. When a call comes in, they first listen to the information given by the reporter. And in Minnesota, most of the reporters are either school officials or law enforcement personnel who happen to be out on another call of some type and learn that a child is perhaps in need of protection or services. So when the Child Protection Department receives this call, they screen these cases into kind of two different types of cases. The first being those cases that are probably low risk. The child is not in an imminent physical danger of harm. And then the other types of cases where imminent danger seems to be a potential. The cases that are the low-risk cases, they conduct a family assessment, which is a family-centered, strengths-based investigation where they talk with the families about the problems that they're encountering, be it neglect or abuse, although if it's sexual abuse or physical abuse, they would not be included in that group. And they try to work with the families outside of the court process to get the families the help that they need. The other types of cases, the ones with the high risk, where physical abuse, sexual abuse, severe mental or emotional abuse is alleged, those cases go into what is called the traditional assessment, where they try to find out how the abuse was caused, who the perpetrator was, and those are the cases that most often end up in the court system. So that's kind of the process, and you'll see that under the bullet that says now treatment determinations, there were, of all the cases that I mentioned earlier, 10,934 of them went into this low-risk family assessment process, so outside of the court system. About 7,000 of them went through this traditional process. And of that, once they completed their investigation, about 4,700 of them, they found that there was indeed neglect or maltreatment of some kind. And that involved about 6,500 children. It's probably no news to any of us that the underlying cause of many of these cases is alcohol and drugs, and we're seeing more and more often that another significant factor is mental health issues. So many of our cases have dual diagnosis of alcohol and drugs as well as mental health. Very difficult to overcome. It's not something you can just go to some clinic and be fixed. It's lifelong oftentimes.
Ms. Nord, I'm curious, are these numbers increasing, or is this about what we expect annually in terms of neglect cases?
Representative Haymar, the incidence of abuse have increased slightly over the last few years, although there seems to be some leveling off on some of these, similar to the out-of-home placements. The home placements, which I'll talk about in a second, have increased some, but not much. I mean, it's a slight percentage. If you'd like more information about trends, we could get that information for you.
Thank you.
So the effects of maltreatment, and this came as a surprise to me because I personally didn't realize this. In 2007, 16 children in Minnesota died of maltreatment. There were 47 victims with life-threatening injuries, 168 with serious injuries, and 635 with moderate injuries. And of all the maltreatment, the majority of the cases were neglect. And some may think that, well, okay, so it was only neglect. What studies will show you is that chronic neglect of children is actually in many ways much more damaging to a child than physical abuse, because it becomes entrenched and it impacts the rest of their entire life, unless they receive the treatment or unless their parents receive the treatment that they need to help them overcome that. So neglect is being shown to be almost more significant, and you'll notice I said almost more significant than physical or sexual abuse. Physical abuse and sexual abuse, however, were the next most significant reasons or causes of the abuse or neglect. In terms of out-of-home placement, of those cases that came into the court system, and I'll talk about that in a second, 14,800 children spent some time in foster care during the year of 2007. Now, many of them spent only a week or two in foster care. So one of the things that we as a state are looking at is, how do we find a way to maybe make sure that those children really needed to come into the care system? Rather than, you know, maybe there's a way to be able to find a way to keep them at home, make sure they're safe, but not have them come into the system if they were only in the system for a few days. And the last thing I'll talk about is the last bullet on the page, and that is the number of petitions that were filed. And that means these are the cases that came into the court system. So we started out with 26,561 children, and it's now kind of whittled down or funneled down so that of that, there were 5,331 CHIPS children. And the way that the court system looks at that is that's not the number of petitions, that's the number of kids involved. And there were also 1,575 TPR petitions. So that hopefully sets the stage for the numbers. And then if you look at the move to the flow chart, I'll walk through what the process is once a case is in the court system. This diagram is set up to show the CHIPS proceedings, and again, that stands for Child in Need of Protection or Services. And then the second phase of the process, which is the permanency phase, and I'll talk about that in a second. You'll see that there are different colored lines. The dark blue line at the top represents the stages in a child protection or CHIPS proceeding. And above that dark blue line, you'll see that there are numbers. Those numbers represent the number of days that a child would be out of home. So walking through that process, and then I'll talk about the permanency process, you'll see that day zero is the day that a child is removed from home. And by statute and court rule, within 72 hours of that removal, there has to be a court hearing. And that's called the Emergency Protective Care Hearing. And at that hearing, the judge determines whether there is, in fact, a child protection case based on the allegations in the petition. And the judge also determines whether the child protection agency did everything they could to prevent the child's removal from home. Typically, that's all that happens at that hearing. But there are some counties where an attorney has been appointed by the time of that hearing, which, by the way, is fairly rare, and I'll talk about that in a second. There are some counties who combine that first emergency hearing with the admit-deny hearing. Most counties, however, come back within 10 days, which is what the rules require, to have an admit-deny hearing. At this hearing, the parents would have already received the petition, which identifies the allegations against them, whether it was sexual abuse, physical abuse, neglect, abandonment, mental neglect, whatever the allegations were. And hopefully they would have had an opportunity to talk with an attorney. Because at that hearing, they are required to either admit the allegations, one or more of them, or deny them. If the allegations are denied by the parent, it then proceeds to a pretrial and then a trial. If the allegations are admitted, then the judge has the authority to order the parents to participate in services that are designed to correct the problem that brought this case and this child and this family into the child protection system in the first place.
Ms. Nord, you said hopefully that they'll have an opportunity to speak to an attorney. So at this stage, does this happen differently in different jurisdictions?
Representative Tamar, the answer is it does. As I mentioned, for the EPC hearing, there are several counties who have found a way to have an attorney present at the EPC hearing. Prior to July 8th, that was most often a public defender. Since July 8th, when the public defenders haven't been representing the parents anymore, some of the counties are no longer able to do that for a variety of reasons, oftentimes because the attorney isn't available or their contract doesn't cover it or things like that. So most often across the state, there is not an attorney available at the EPC hearing. At that hearing, though, is where the judge typically appoints an attorney. And so between that hearing and the next hearing, is where the attorney would hopefully meet with the client. Now, typically, that first meeting would often happen outside of that hearing, like minutes before that hearing. It's not the best practice. One of the things that the Children's Justice Initiative has struggled to do is try to find a way to get attorneys to meet with their clients for a significant period of time prior to that. And the reason that we say that is because at these first two hearings, the tone of the way a child protection case might proceed is often set at that. At this hearing, for example, if the parent admits the petition, what the judge will do is make a decision about where that child is going to live. Is it safe for the child to go home? If not, where does that child go? Is there a relative that's available that's safe? Or if not, what foster care placement? So that's one of the first decisions that the judge makes, is where is the child going to live? Another decision the judge makes is, if the child's not at home, what visitation will there be? And what kind? Is it supervised or unsupervised? The judge also makes a decision about what services does this child need? And that's something that the judge can order even if mom and dad have not admitted, or even if there hasn't been an adjudication yet. So the judge can always order services for the child. The child, if the child's been traumatized or abused, might need psychological help, might need medical assistance, medical help. So the judge can always order that. The judge cannot order the parent to do anything if there has not been an adjudication or if the parent hasn't agreed. So again, one of the things that an attorney would be doing at this point of the case is counseling their client to help them understand, for example, if the allegation was physical abuse, and maybe that physical abuse was based on the abuse of alcohol or drugs, which, by the way, is many, many, many of our court cases that we see these days, from meth to alcohol addiction. One of the things that's really critical is, because we only have 12 months for this child to be returned home, is to make sure those parents get the help that they need immediately. And one of the roles of the attorney, besides being their legal representative, is being a coach, a counselor, in the truest sense of the word, counseling their client to understand that they need to try to get help so that they can get their children back or their child back within the 12 months, and to get that started as soon as possible. So most counties have an attorney representing the parent by the time of the admit-deny hearing. Assuming there is an adjudication, which means the judge has found that, yes, the allegations in this petition are true, it then moves on to the adjudication. So the judge issues an adjudication order, and as part of that includes the disposition, which is what I was talking about earlier. Where does the child live? What visitation is there? What services does the child and parent need? And what is the social services agency going to be providing? It's all part of something called the case plan, which is something that's required in every case. And then after that hearing, you come back into court at least every 90 days, according to court rule, to review that. And those are called disposition review hearings. During those hearings, the judge receives reports from the social workers and the guardians ad litem in which the progress of the parent is discussed and measured, and the information and services provided by the social services agency are discussed. And try to find out, are mom and dad on track? Are they doing everything they need? And again, the role of the attorney in that is critical, to advocate for the services that this parent might need. And they need to be culturally appropriate, and they need to be accessible to that parent. In rural areas, if, for example, you live in a city where there isn't chemical health classes or chemical health treatment, you might have to travel 100 miles. Even though you don't have transportation, you don't have your own vehicle, you might have to rely on somebody to get you there. So there's this tension between doing these services and accepting these services that you need in order to get your child back, and maybe not having those services available to you.
Representative Bigham, you had a question?
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know you've touched briefly on the attorney part about the inconsistency maybe throughout some of the jurisdictions, but if you go to the EPC hearing or in the pretrial hearing, is that attorney the same attorney throughout the whole process, or sometimes does that fluctuate? Because you had stressed a lot here about how the consistency within the attorney is important, but But I'm wondering, is that actually happening, where it's the same attorney throughout the whole process?
Ms. Norris.
Representative Tamar, Representative. I believe that for the most part, it is the same attorney. Now, there would be some exception, obviously, if that attorney happens to be sick. But since the Children's Justice Initiative started about 8 years ago, most counties not only have the same attorney for the parent, but the same guardian ad litem, and now in many, many counties, the same judge. That continuity in decision-making and counseling is critical. And Minnesota is doing actually quite well in that area. Just to continue with the rest of the flowchart, as I mentioned, there would be a number of these disposition review hearings. Some counties hold them more often, especially in those cases where maybe the parents are more entrenched in whatever the issue was. But at some point, if that child doesn't go home, then the Minnesota statutes require that we have to think of another alternative permanent placement for this child. And under Minnesota law, what that means is by month 11, so if you look at the place where it says day 335, by that date, the county is required to file a petition, which would identify their thoughts about what the best permanency plan for this child would be. And that's where all those other colored lines come in. There are five permanency options for children if they can't go home. The first one, and the paramount consideration, obviously, for children in Minnesota is safety, and we try to reunify wherever possible. But if that's not possible, then the red line shows that one of the permanency options is termination of parental rights, which would then lead to adoption. The next alternative is transfer of permanent and legal and physical custody to a relative. The third one is long-term foster care. And the fourth one is foster care for a specified period of time. And there's one that I forgot to include in here, which is guardianship to the commissioner. Most often in Minnesota, either TPR, termination of parental rights, long-term foster care, or transfer of custody are the three most used options in Minnesota. So at day 335, there is this permanency petition that's filed. And by day 365, there's an admit-deny hearing on that petition. So again, this petition would be served upon the parents. It would explain why the petition is being filed. It would explain that, for example, the parents were not able to complete their treatment or their progress in their case plan. And then the court would have a hearing on that. If the parent admits it, then the judge, for example, would terminate parental rights. If the parent denies it, it would go to a trial, and at the conclusion of the trial, the judge would either grant the TPR or not grant it. And depending on the permanency option that is determined by the judge, there may be additional hearings. So, for example, if there's a TPR, it would take a little while for the adoption to be finalized. So there are hearings at least every 90 days leading up to the adoption. And that's to make sure the child's getting the services they need and the adoption is moving along. Same thing with transfer of custody. There could be hearings on that to make sure that, for example, if the child goes to live with grandmother, that everything is the way we thought it would be, that grandma understands this child's needs and is actually helping the child. Or if there's long-term foster care, there are hearings required at least annually. So that's a broad, very high-end, very quick overview of the child protection process.
Very good. Thank you for your presentation. Questions? All right. Then, Justice Meyer, do you want to talk about the working group, or I'm not sure what...
Yeah, sure. I would, and I would ask that... Attorney Jim Backstrom join me. Mr. Backstrom is a Dakota County attorney, and he's probably familiar with some, if not all of you.
I think so. Welcome, Mr. Backstrom.
He wears a lot of hats.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
What I'd like to do is talk about our group for a minute. You've been provided with two documents. The first is the report of the Parent Legal Representation Work Group. And it looks like this, and you also have an executive summary. Let me direct you to the report of the work group first of all. Page 18 of that report And I think the last page of the executive summary also lists the membership of our work group. So you have a sense of the breadth and depth of experience that was brought to the table. Elected officials, obviously, Representative Hillstrom, among them, Mr. Backstrom, public defense representatives, county representatives, and so forth. Our group was brought together at the request of the Judicial Council, and I have to tell you, we're not the first group to be brought together to address this issue. The legislature, I think it was in 06, brought together a group to address this very same question of how to, what to do with the mandate that all parents and children in these cases are entitled to effective representation of counsel. The Judicial Council brought this group together in the fall of last year in response to a decision that was made by the Board of Public Defense to withdraw from representation in CHIPS and TPR cases for parents around the state. And the background for that decision was a difficult one. It was made by the Board of Public Defense in response to fiscal pressures that existed at that time and continue to exist and will probably only get worse with time. The immediate response of the Judicial Council was to try to understand if there was an administrative solution that the judicial branch could take and how to bring attorneys to the table. The decision was made by the council to appoint this work group to study the question and make some recommendations. What has happened in the meantime, and I'll tell you about our findings in a minute, but what's happened in the meantime is that each county essentially has taken its own approach to whether they will provide funding for attorneys in these cases. And we did, as part of our report, and this is a changing picture every day, but as part of our report at Appendix C, which is page 25 of the full report, there is a summary of how various counties around the state are responding to the court's request that the responsibility for attorneys' representation be shifted to them. Let me briefly just give you the statutory framework. There's some critical provisions in the statutes, and again, we've attached as Exhibit B. You'll find the statutes. Excuse me. I think they begin at page 19 of the materials, but let me touch on them quickly. First is, and I think the most important, Minnesota Statute 260C.163, Subdivision 3, which in essence says that children and parents involved in child protection cases have the right to effective assistance of counsel. So in essence, a civil right to an attorney. I want to emphasize, this is a civil case. It's different from the effective right to counsel in a criminal case. The effective right to counsel in a criminal case is grounded in the federal constitution and in the state constitution. The civil right to counsel has been established in Minnesota by statute, and that's the statute from which it flows. The second, I think, important statutory provision it's a subdivision of that same statute. It says the court shall appoint an attorney for a parent or guardian if the parent or guardian qualifies financially, and the court determines that appointment is appropriate. So this then gives the court authority to appoint an attorney for the parent. And in the truancy cases, there's a provision also where an attorney may be appointed, but only if the child is going to be placed out of the home. And this sometimes happens in truancy. There's a separate provision dealing with the Indian Child Welfare Act, And here's where the statutes break down a little bit. The fifth point, now I'm now working on page 4 of our report. If the court determines that a child age 10 or older is entitled to a court-appointed attorney, a child age 10 and over, the child is entitled to be represented by a public defender. Now, this is the one reference in the statute where the public defender shall represent this subgroup of people involved in child protection. And the public defender system in Minnesota continues to provide representation for these children. The statutes don't say, though, who shall be appointed to represent parents or who pays for the services of parents. And that's the gap in the statute. There's another provision, and there's our committee. Let me just check what the sixth provision is. And this is found at MnSTAT 375.1691.
Hold off for 1 second. We have a question. I don't want to get too far. Too far ahead if the question pertains to one of the statutes that you just referenced. Representative Cornish.
Your Honor, what's the difference? Now, you referred to the constitutional right and the civil right. How much weight does that civil right statutory requirement have? Can we just ignore it and say, well, we don't want to pay any attention to that one? Or who enforces that civil right? If you make the statement, who's the enforcer that says, hey, I'm going to come to enforce it, and you're going to do it?
Justice Meyer.
Representative Cornish, Chairman Paymar, I'm not the one who can tell you that you can ignore statutes. I would advise against it, actually.
Well, the reason I ask is kind of a roundabout way. Our cities and counties are ignoring statutes right now, and so with the administrative fine thing, I'd want to bring that up, but this whole thing, it brings to light which statutes and which rights can a county attorney or somebody else say, I'm going to ignore that one, and I'm going to have to enforce this one, and I want money for it. So,
Representative Cornish, Chairman Paymar, it's a philosophical question, maybe. I don't know the answer to that. I think that my colleague, Mr. Backstrom, can tell you how counties make some of these decisions. What I'm saying to you is that there is a mandate for effective legal representation in these cases. And in great part, it appears to be an unfunded mandate at this point.
Mr. Chair, just a comment, Andy. This has taken on a whole interesting sphere here because right now we're faced with a judicial system that's threatening to decriminalize everything because of lack of funding. The county attorneys that want to divert things that are lack of funding, and the public defenders have deserted a certain area because of lack of funding. And it's just all these threats coming at once to change the whole criminal system because of money. And then so that's why the right and the mandate is so important to me. When does the buck stop, and what do you really have to do, and what legality do you really have to pay any attention to? It's just problematic for me, but thank you.
Mr. Hilson, is it to this point? Or
it's actually to Representative Cornish's point, Mr. Chair.
Go for it,
Representative. All right, thank you. Representative Cornish, I've been working on this CHIPS issue since Representative Smith was the Chair of Public Safety, and we attempted to come up with a compromise and actually did have a compromise last year, and at the last minute, the Senate did not accept the compromise, which resulted in what happened with the public defenders, saying that they were no longer going to represent parents.
Representative Hillstrom, would you mind just, because I was, Ms. McMahon and I were talking about it yesterday, and I was trying to remember what your bill did. I don't want to get too far off your presentation, but can you just, 30 seconds, explain it?
Mr. Chair, it was just a compromise between all the parties as to who was going to be appointed and who was going to pay. And so they were working that out, and at the last minute, that just didn't come to fruition, and the Senate didn't accept it.
So was it a mix of fiscal responsibility for the for representation? Or?
I would say that that's the case. The public defenders were going to continue to represent parents, and other folks were going to help bear the burden of the cost. And so, Mr. Chair, I wanted to say that really the statutes are not clear. The parents do have a right to representation. but it doesn't say that the state shall pay for it. It doesn't say who should pay for it and who should do that. And so this has been a very sticky issue, and I applaud this group for continuing to work on this. Basically, the legislature has to decide if we think it's important enough to not only mandate that someone be appointed, but then mandate who can pay for it as well.
So. Representative Cornish, you have anything? Justice Meyer, please continue.
Thank you, Chairman. Let me just make a comment about the perspective of this group and the thrust of our report generally. This is not a report about the rights of parents directly. And there are people who will come before you and advocate for the right to counsel, because the loss of the right to parent your child, many people would say, is a fundamental right. And it's the right of the parent to have representation and to protect themselves against that loss that's key. I'm not here to make that case, and our committee isn't here to make that case. We're here to make the case for the welfare of children. And our report focused on what happens to kids in a system where the parents aren't represented. And the fact is, what happens to parents is one thing, and we're not really addressing that in our report. What we're addressing is what happens to these cases when there isn't effective representation for the parent. And what happens is that there are bad outcomes for children. We have a very short time frame. If you look at the flow chart, we're mandated to get these kids to permanency within a year. And that's a long time in a child's life, and it's a short time in a parent's life who's had a life of chemical dependency or mental health or alcohol addiction or abuse themselves. And the issue is one of helping these kids. Parents who aren't represented don't get it. They don't get that at that first hearing, they have to be on the page and they have to be ready to work to get the problem solved. And the goal is to keep these families together. I mean, that's the primary goal, if it's in the best interest of the child. And what we've laid out in the report is what happens to the system when the parent doesn't have an advocate there. And it's, in essence, that family doesn't have an advocate there. And I think we will see more kids going into termination. We will see more care plans not being followed. We'll see more parents not getting it. And that's the role of the attorney. The role of the attorney is to be there advocating for the parent, certainly, but ultimately advocating for the best interests of the child, which is what this whole system is built around. The committee looked at a variety of solutions. One that we looked at was, can we call on pro bono attorneys in our state? You know, we have some pro bono representation right now of children, for example, in Ramsey County. The Children's Law Center represents children 10 and over in these cases. And we looked seriously at whether we could marshal volunteer attorneys to do this work. We were really pushed in this direction by Mike Ford, who's president of the Minnesota State Bar Association. And he went around the state sort of workshopping this idea. You know, can we get volunteer lawyers? And the committee unanimously recommended against it. Several reasons. These cases are essentially hotly contested child custody cases. And for those of you who are lawyers and have been in court, these are the toughest cases for lawyers or the toughest cases for judges. You cannot get lawyers to volunteer for contested custody cases because of the amount of time that they take. The pool of attorneys is very low. And I can lay out the case, some other sort of statistics for how we came to that recommendation. But the bottom line is that we have a mandate to get these kids into permanent, healthy environments Without an advocate in the courtroom for the parent, we don't believe, and we've laid out some studies that support this, but we don't believe that the best interests of those children will be protected. And why do we care about these kids? We care about them because 80% of the people in our prisons today came through the child protection system. So this is not just something to make this kid feel good or to make this family feel good on a temporary basis. This is a long-term problem with hopefully a solution.
One more question before you move on, Representative Bingham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a brief question. One, I happen to think if you offer attorneys CLEs because they love to do them, maybe that may sweeten the deal to do some pro bono work. But during that discussion, what about a group, and I'm really exploring this idea because I think it's something that in these times we may have to take a look at. What about not just blatantly offering pro bono to just any old attorney that wants to do it, but what about a pool of attorneys that maybe have experience doing this for doing it pro bono or offering CLEs if they have some training? You know, there are a lot of people that, you know, maybe work for the big firms because that pays the bills, but really would love to on a basis do some of this work that maybe wouldn't pay the bills normally had they chose this area of law. So, I mean, I think it kind of serves a dual purpose, and it supports the families, and it helps the children get the parents and children get the representation that we need in these very important cases. So I would guess maybe if you could elaborate a little bit more on that discussion.
Justice Meyer.
Yes, Justice Chairman Hamer. When we looked at these cases, we try to get a sense of how much attorney time is needed. And this also is important to know for funding purposes. How much time do these cases take on average? Our best conservative estimate is that the average case takes 40 plus hours of volunteer time, of attorney time. That's just court time. But you have to add a factor to that for the counseling time that we hope happens between the attorney and the client. Lawyers who volunteer then, I mean, it would be the average that a lawyer would volunteer in a year would be 40 hours. That would be a lot of volunteer time for a lawyer to volunteer a week of their time to a pro bono activity. And it would mean they could handle one case. So there's just that sort of a challenge of the numbers. But the other challenge, and maybe more importantly, is the challenge of the complexity of the law. If you look at the juvenile protection rules, it's a very complex set of rules. It's a complex set of federal statutes. And the complexity is added to because you have all of society's social problems piled in these cases. You have, as we've mentioned, mental health, chemical, alcohol, dysfunction, I mean, poverty, you know, you name it, and it's there. And so it just, you know, we'd like to continue to explore that possibility, but it just, because of the time it takes and the complexity of the case, we just didn't feel that we could responsibly advance it as a solution. We do have some CLE credits available to lawyers for pro bono work. That was a recent change the court approved. It's nominal. I think for every 4 hours of pro bono time that you contribute, you can earn an hour of CLE credit in a year. But I do want to turn it to
Justice Meyer. We have one more question before you go on, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm an attorney, but I have never worked in this area, and I'm sitting here kind of listening and kind of want to sort of propose an idea and maybe I'm way off base, but if as you explained before, the real point here is the welfare of the children, not so much the representation of the parents. I mean, in an ideal world, everybody would have great counsel and their rights would really be upheld, and I understand this is a civil process, but it's still an adversarial process. But if our point here is really about the welfare of the children, and if the function of the attorney toward that goal is one of counseling the parents, as you described, and making sure they understand the urgency of their need of, you know, get it together now or you're going to lose your rights and that kind of thing, my question is whether that role could be filled by somebody who's not an attorney at all and doesn't pretend to be an attorney and isn't there for the adversarial court piece, but is really there explicitly to give the parent that direction. And, you know, and if that would be possible, I mean, obviously it's not counsel. You need to pretend that it was counsel. The person could still have a right to counsel if they could get counsel. But to fill that role, maybe we could do that in a very different way and still get the kind of result for the kids that I think we all agree that we need to have. Is that something that was ever considered?
Justice Meyer.
Representative Chairman Paymer, I'm hogging the time, and I'm happy to turn this question to my colleague, or I can answer it to him. I just want to be sure you get a chance to weigh in.
Mr. Baxter, you want to respond to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, it's an interesting point you raise. The group did not discuss that particular aspect of this issue. I think the right to legal representation, as was indicated earlier by Ms. Nord, is a statutory requirement. If statutes aren't that clear as to who's going to pay for it and that sort of thing, but currently the law requires that there be attorneys involved, and it's important for a number of reasons that happen. It speeds up the court process. It results in a better understanding of the parents of their responsibilities under the law. It protects the rights of parents. The parents have rights too. And, you know, we're talking about taking, in many cases, their children out of their home, away from them, in some cases permanently severing their relationship with their children. They have a right to legal counsel when we're talking about one of the most important relationships there is, and we're trying to sever that as a state. They have the right to have counsel representing them, and I would submit that that's a little more than just some non-lawyer providing some advice as well. So the attorneys also promote compliance with the recommendations of the case plans and the court orders. They accelerate the permanency determination. You know, when attorneys are involved, it does shorten the duration of out-of-home placement, so it saves us money. And I think it's clear. If you look at page 15 of the report, there was a study in New York City, and it talks about the amount of money that can be saved by shortening out-of-home placements, by having these decisions processed quicker through the court process. It saves a significant amount of money on the back end if we're able to fund the legal representation on the front end. So that's really what's at stake here, and I would submit that in many cases that does require legal representation and not just counseling advice. Although, I'm not saying that's insignificant and not important. But I think the attorney's role provides more than just that. If I might, Mr. Chair, because I know Justice Meyer wanted me to talk about the work group findings and the recommendations to proceed into...
One moment, Mr. Jackson. We have a question for Representative Lane.
Well, I'd just like to follow up on what Representative Liebling brought forth, because as I was listening to you before say that this entrenched family situation is of neglect can be more damaging even than an isolated case of abuse. Not to lower the abuse. However, if the most important thing in a child's growing, in the early years especially, is the emotional responsivity of the primary provider, and if this group may not be familiar with this, but in the Romanian orphanages long ago, or during the war, or after, anyway, a while ago, children died when they were physically cared for perfectly, but there was nobody there for them. There was no emotional responsivity, and they died for lack of love. And they were perfectly physically taken care of, and they died. This is so key. And now when you say 80% of prisoners in our courts, in our prisons came out of the child protection system, 80%. It's just phenomenal to me. Have we actually addressed this issue? Is it totally about, and I'm not to disparage parental rights, but if our attention is for the child, are we actually coming at it the right way? Do we just want to permanently place them someplace and not to terminate parents' rights? Or are we actually there for the child to stop this 80% of our prisoners coming out of the child protection system, meaning that their background, their childhood was abominable? And if this is how children grow, are we looking in the right way? And is there something, not just counseling for the parents or soft advice for the parents, but is this in fact what the services are when you say you must get services or you will lose your parents' rights? Those services are stop drinking, stop this approach to life, stop this drug abuse, straighten out. This is serious business, and you're saying that the attorney's job is to make it clear to them how serious it is. But the services that they then have to take are the things that would hopefully turn them around. Are we then emphasizing the right thing here? I'm not disparaging the fact that they need the court services, the counseling, the lawyer services. However, I would just say I am aghast at how are we doing it well for the future of these children, for the future of these citizens.
Mr. Smyer, do you want to respond to that, or?
You know, it's a profound question without an easy answer. And what I can tell you is that we have a body of federal law that is driving our system, and that the federal law has made policy decisions about how to go about this. And let me just tell you that two things. One is that I was emphasizing the counseling role, but the unique thing about the attorney representation in these cases is that they have a dual role. And I was emphasizing the counseling one, but the other role is as legal advocate. I mean, you know, if you're going to have a trial to terminate your parental rights, you need a lawyer in that case arguing for your side. And so it's a dual role, and I was emphasizing the counseling role because as a front end, that is certainly clear. And important. But just to give you a sense of these cases, if the judge will order the parent to make certain behavioral changes, you will remain chemically free, you will show up for urinalysis testing, you will attend parenting classes, you will get a job, you will get an apartment that's suitable for this child to live in with you. I mean, it is a very specific, directed behavioral modification approach. And if parents can't and don't do it, the county does move to terminate. If the parent demonstrates their utter failure to fix the problem. And the tension is that some of these problems can't be fixed within the time that the statutes say they need to be. It's very difficult for someone who's chemically dependent to fix that problem within a year. And that's what the system contemplates, that not all parents, you know, can do what's necessary. And so there is teeth there. But the policy decision about how to deal with children who are in these homes, I mean, that's one that's been made by the federal government, and you know we're being measured now, and I have to mention that as well. We're being measured on how well we're complying with the federal mandate in bringing kids to permanency. And Minnesota just went through an audit, and we referenced this in our report. And Minnesota, like every other state right now, is not in compliance with federal standards. Not being in compliance is a bad thing. And there's a plan right now to
to improve it. And, you know, if there was some expectation, we wouldn't be in compliance. And I've got, you know, there are people in our committee and people in human services who can speak much more directly about the audit that we went through on permanency for kids. It's very tough to get permanency within the time that the statutes allow. But
I want one more comment or question from members, and then I want Mr. Backstrom to give us the recommendations from the working group, and then we have other testifiers also. Representative Olin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is mainly a comment, and I'm putting back my prosecutor's hat of 32 years before I become the state representative. Part of the challenge we deal with, and it answers some of the problems that exist, as to that 80% number, is in not too distant past, we were in a world where we tried to keep children at home was the main emphasis. It's been only a few years, and I can't remember exactly how many, that we've actually went to the true system of using the permanency rules, which are far better than what we used to do in the old days. But at the not too many years ago, when I was still during my county attorney's years, we were in a world where we tried a lot harder to keep people at home. And under that system, and I'll speak from one case I know of, I dealt with a young lady that I ended up terminating under our new rules, and she was totally baffled because we kept her and tried to keep her at home for quite a few years because there has been a change in the system. And I'm certainly not going to say the change hasn't been good, because I think it has been good. But that's part of what the old problem was. There was a little more emphasis on keeping people at home than there presently is.
Mr. Paxton, would you give the recommendations of the working group, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, based on the collective experience and expertise of this working group, and it was a wide ranging group, as Justice Meyer indicated, I'd encourage you to take a look at who all was a part of that. The work group made a number of findings and some recommendations, and the findings are that the objective of child protection court proceedings is to timely achieve child safety, permanency, and well-being, and to protect the best interests of Indian children as well under the ICWA Act, and to promote stability and security for the families, and obviously whenever that is in a situation where the child can be safe and cared for. The goal is to reunify the families, if that's at all possible, and we work towards that, and we can't achieve that goal without adequate representation. Representation of parents in child protection proceedings by qualified and culturally competent attorneys improves the outcomes for children, both the children and families, and that's the reason why representation is important. And that representation is also a cost-effective investment, as I indicated, that can avoid long-term expenses such as extended foster care costs. It improves judicial decision-making by having representation available. It speeds up the process, and it will result in greater compliance here in Minnesota with the federal standards. The recommendations specifically are to clarify the law. Although we have statutes in place here, those statutes do need to be amended, we believe, the work group believes, to make sure it's clear as to what the obligations are and the responsibilities are. That parents have the right to legal representation should be clearly a mandate under the law, that they have a right to a court-appointed attorney if they're indigent. If they're able to pay, the parents should be able to hire their own attorneys, obviously, and we need to make sure the courts are vigilant in reviewing their financial status. But indigent parents clearly have a right and should have a right and a mandate to court-appointed counsel. That counsel should be available in all of these cases. Indigent parents of Indian children as well, regardless of their party status, have the same rights, should have the same rights under the law. We need to make sure that that's clear. And that this legal representation does need to be provided by culturally competent and qualified and trained attorneys. And that's one of the challenges in reference to the pro bono area, is making just sure this is a complex area of the law, has been indicated, and to make sure that the attorneys that work in this area are properly trained. And it's great that pro bono attorneys want to volunteer their time, but it's simply not possible to set up a system to handle the volume of cases that we have through simply a pro bono process. And we would encourage pro bono attorneys that are trained in the area to assist us whenever they can, and that would be greatly accepted. But to have that as the backbone of the process simply is not going to work, not here in the metro area or across our state. The legal representation in these cases does need to continue until a permanent placement is made for the child, and that includes through any appeal process as well. The second and perhaps the most important recommendation of the work group is who's going to pay for the service. The work group does believe this needs to be a state-funded program. It has to be consistent and uniform across the state. Right now we have a wide range of differences that are going on because of the public defender's withdrawal from of this work, and we need to have consistency and state-funded representation, and it either should be dedicated in a separate entity of the Board of Public Defense or a separate entity altogether that could be created, perhaps some legal aid entity that could be designated to provide this work and to make sure that they have the properly trained attorneys to do that. So that, in essence, is the recommendation of the work group. The details are contained in the report. I thank you for the opportunity to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity to be a part of this important work. This is one of the highest priorities, I can tell you, for Minnesota's county attorneys. We're talking about protecting the safety and well-being of our children. There isn't anything more important than that. And I speak not only on behalf of county attorneys, but our child protection agencies that work in this area that provide outstanding work as well. Strongly support the recommendations of this report. Thank you.
Mr. Baxton, did the working group study how other states are funding this kind of representation for parents?
Mr. Chair, I'd have to defer to Judy or Justice Meyer. She knows the answer to that.
Justice
I don't
Meyer,
believe
do you?
We extensively looked at that.
We did. We didn't provide in our materials a survey of the other states. Most states do have a central state-funded program, and the states who have the most effective representation, that's the model that they use. And if it would be helpful to this group, we can pull that data back together. We have it. We just didn't attach this part of our appendix.
I read the report and didn't see it, so that would be helpful to the, if you could make that available to the committee. We have two questions, and then we also have testifiers, and I would like to adjourn the meeting at 10. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, maybe somebody else is thinking about this too. Thank you for all your hard work, and it was a good product. But the only thing that disappoints me a little bit is that going into this, we knew we needed the assumptions you came up with of right to legal representation, since they should be trained, it should be a funding, separate funding source. We pretty much knew that, general scene, but I would wish you got a little bit more specific and give us some ideas on how. And maybe you will yet if we talk to you one-on-one, but what do you really mean by the change in the law? Some examples. How much training should they have? And then finally, I wish you would give us just bounce some ideas off, maybe list several of us to pick from about a separate funding source. And finally, the chair's idea here of studies in other states and how they're dealing with it. Just more some specific ideas that we could at least bounce around and.
So, of course, did you want those today, or can they come?
No, hurry. I just wish that some of that could have been in there, but a place to start from.
So, obviously, the committee is interested, and we have some decisions to make this year. So, any additional information to help us make that decision would be helpful. Justice Meyer, Representative Cole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that I'm generally in agreement with the recommendations, but let me ask, I guess, the $5.2 billion question. What would it cost to implement the recommendations that the group has come forward with? I don't know if that's for Justice Meyer or maybe something to follow up on later, but I don't see that in the report. I read through it quickly. I don't know if that was discussed.
Justice Meyer, do you have a response?
Yes, Representative Chairman Tamar. We were not asked to put together a fiscal note of any kind, but we certainly could put something together, and I think that the State Board of Public Defense probably has some good data that would help pull that together as well.
Oh, and
Mr. Stewart, can you address that real quickly, or no? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Backstrom. If you can hold on to probably a small question. Mr. Stewart, could you quickly maybe respond to that question? I think that's
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is John Stewart. I'm the state public defender. I previously was a CHIPS lawyer in Hennepin County for 10 years, and I was on the three previous working groups that studied this issue before this one. If we take the figure of 40 hours going into each one of these cases, typically over the last 5 years, the Board of Public Defense has had about 8,000 parent cases. We feel that a lawyer can work about 2,000 hours a year. So at 40 hours apiece, that's one lawyer working full-time could handle 50 cases in a year. Now, it may be that it's more time-consuming than 40 hours a week if you figure in more out-of-court time, but let's say 50 hours apiece, or 50 cases per lawyer. We would need 160 full-time lawyers plus support staff to handle these 8,000 parent cases. This has been costed out by previous task forces in various amounts ranging from about 10 to about $15 million a year. So I'm sorry that that's not a pretty picture, but that would be realistic. Right now, the State Board of Public Defense, to do everything it does, has a little under 400 full-time lawyers handling all the misdemeanors, felonies, juvenile delinquency, etc.
So after you pulled the plug on this last year, the year before, so the county is reimbursing public defenders now. Is that the way that this process is working? Who are handling these cases?
Mr. Chair, I wouldn't call them public defenders. I'd say that they're court-appointed counsel, just like the county-funded court-appointed counsel that do mental commitment defense and paternity case defense. Now there are court-appointed panels in, I think, 85 of the 87 counties that are doing this work, and the counties are reluctantly, and I understand their reluctance, but they're paying for it.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. For County Attorney Backstrom, I have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Stewart.
In your recommendation, too, you're suggesting and recommending a quote, separate statewide funding source to provide the provide these requirements. Mr. Backstrom, separate statewide funding source, and I can think of one in particular, and the firefighter training service account has been established as a separate entity, but in time of deficit, it's been visited. I won't say the word looted, but it's been visited like other funding sources to pay for the general expenses of the state. So wouldn't it be a better plan to not recommend a separate state funding source and just get right to the point and recommend that this committee, finance committee, and that the legislature and the governor recognize that the providing of justice is the primary task of our government, and that this is a portion of that, and that in the overall picture, the judiciary is the third branch and not a simple agency.
Mr. Baxter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I think you're absolutely right. This does need to have, I think when we use the word source, I think we're talking about this needs to be a state-wide, state-funded program. And it is part of our judicial responsibilities and branch. It's obviously interrelated with the executive branch, the judicial branch, and so forth. But it does need to have consistency and uniformity and statewide on a statewide basis. And that was, in essence, the nature of this. I don't think we were speaking of creating, you know, a separate pool of money somehow. But you know, but it does need to be uniform statewide. You're absolutely right.
That's all. Thank you. Before I call on you, Representative Hilton, I just want to get a sense, besides Mr. Tuma representing the Metropolitan or County Association, is there anybody in the audience who wishes to address the committee on this issue, just so I can keep track of the time? Mr. Stewart and this gentleman here. Okay, Representative Hilton, you see we're running out of time.
I will be brief, okay. Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make certain that the committee knew that while the Judicial Council requested that this group be put in place, we should address what the Judicial Council's position was coming forward, just so this committee is clear on whether or not this is a proposal coming from the Judicial Council or not. I'm strongly supportive of the recommendations, but if the testifiers could address that would be great.
Justice Meyer, Mr. Baxter.
Yes, Representative Hilstrom, Chairman Paymart. The Judicial Council accepted our report in December. They voted to not advance any legislation. And as I understand it, the reason was that unless the legislation relates directly to the judiciary, that the policy of the council is not to advance those legislative changes. But this report, I think the thinking was that this report was hopefully a catalyst for other interested groups to advance legislation. And it's the best I can say. And there's a am I capturing that right, Judy? I think so.
Okay, anything else? Mr. Backstrom, Justice Meyer, thank you for your presentation. Mr. Toomer, do you want to address the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is John Tuma. For the record, I represent the Minnesota Inter-County Association. I was asked to kind of give the county's perspective, county government perspective, on what is occurring here. I would have had someone smarter than me be here, but she's actually over at the tax hearing right now talking about maintenance of efforts and unfunded mandates, and that is in Judith Brumfield, who served on a task force. I also served on this task force. And I can tell you, if you think these statutes are confusing, and if you look at them and say, boy, this is a mess, you're correct. They are. I wish I could blame Jeff Diebel, but he was probably playing midget hockey at the time when this problem first began, and it wasn't a drafting problem. It wasn't like someone sat down and said, let us draft a real confusing statute. What happened, really quick from a county perspective, is that we used to have a county court system in Minnesota. It was the counties. Representative Olin probably worked back when there was a county court system in those days. And there were county-appointed public defenders who worked in various areas all over the state appointed by the counties, and we paid for them. And that's why you see statutes left over from past years that talk about counties paying for child protection cases and several other areas. It is a little bit confusing. There are still areas where counties do provide representation to indigent people. For example, one was mentioned earlier, when someone is being civilly committed, we are providing the legal representation in those situations. We even provide some of the additional costs for appeals, transcripts, things like that we're still paying for out of the old statute. What started happening in 1990 was essentially a takeover of the state court system. That's why we have a state court system now and not a county court system. And one of those takeovers happened in the public defense area. Starting in 1990, the 8th District was served by the Board of Public Defense, and by 1995, all of the state of Minnesota was served by the Board of Public Defense. Hennepin County is a little bit of an oddity in that they decided not to participate directly, and then they still provide a lot of the funding for the public defenders. The reason this happened is us counties gave up a significant amount of our aid. At the time, it was known as HACA. It was a dollar-for-dollar transfer. He said, here, state of Minnesota, take back the money you've been giving us, and you start doing this. And they invested that responsibility in the Board of Public Defense. Unfortunately, the statutes were never really clarified in this area. This really was kind of, unfortunately, the orphan stepchild of the process. No one really thought about the child protection cases. And by default, the public defenders started doing them. There's a principle in law, we call it part performance. And it should establish that there's a contract if you start performing the terms of that contract. And we always understood, and part of the process was that the public defenders were going to take up representation of anybody in child protection cases. And they did do that. They did do that for a number of years. They had been doing it from 1995 without a question. The courts didn't order it. It just happened when they took it over. They didn't cite any statutes. They didn't need to. Everybody understood that the people who are public defenders represented parents in child protection cases. That's just because that's the way it was for years in the old county court system. And these are the people that did it. In 2001, there was a criminal justice initiative that started with Justice Blatch and the Human Service Director of the state, getting together saying, we need to improve how we do this. And part of that was to have more attorneys in the courtroom in these child protection cases to enhance the placement of these children in a permanency situation as opposed to leaving them not. When the public defenders took over this in 1995, they were handling about 4,000 appointments at that time. And I'm sure they'll point to you that that rose by 2006, that rose to about 9,000 appointments. And in part it was because of a state initiative and a state court initiative under the CJI, or the Children's Justice Initiative. Unfortunately, on July, the Board of Public Defense said, you know, the statute is unclear here. We have taken significant cuts, and we are going to no longer represent these individuals. Counties were thrusted then with the responsibility of deciding what to do. And you have in your chart there, or as a chart in your thing, an Appendix C that was cited before, so you can check what your counties are doing. But several counties, actually at that time, four counties, specifically said, we are not going to represent or pay for representation in child protection cases. Two of those cases are now finally moving through the system. My home county, Rice County, with Judge Neville overseeing the hearing, made a determination that the counties are going to pay. And they should actually establish a system to figure out how to pay for that. He haven't got his legislative hat off yet, and so he basically told the counties, you must create a system. Our county attorney is defending it, saying there is really no clear mandate, and there's a lot of confusing statutes on funding that have overlaid this that have been ignored for years.
Can you wrap up, please?
Yep. Finally, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I just wanted to answer Representative Hillstrom's question really quick, and I just wanted to give you that history of how we have given up significant aid in order to allow the system to be run by the state, and now it's being thrust back on us. The fiscal note that the public defenders used was $11 million for this, funding this in the last two bienniums. Bad timing on this. Justice Black went to Jim Pawlenty's office to talk about funding this. The day she showed up was when he got the forecast for the 2003 budget crisis. So this is kind of the bad timing thing. We're again bad timing, but Justice Hillstrom, excuse me, the Honorable Chairman of the Policy Committee. I used to make that mistake all the time when I first came to call everybody Honorable. Carried the bill. It was actually 2 years ago. We worked out the compromise on this. And it was essentially that all parents who were custodial parents received representation from the public defenders. Non-custodial parents, if they were made a party by the court, would get a public defender, and the counties would reimburse them. That's when Representative Olin, I first got him all excited the first time I saw him get really angry at me in committee, and we found out that it was $75 a day is the reimbursement we would provide. And if you look at the chart, talking about the funding levels, it is about $75 a day that we're funding them. We are still open to a shared responsibility. We want to work with the judicial system and with you in trying to figure this out. We strongly support the recommendations. Justice Meyer did a fabulous job. Mrs. Knorr did a fabulous job bringing this all together. We want to answer some of the questions about how we find a source of revenue for you, and we're willing to participate again in a shared responsibility. Our county attitude is, we understand the depth of your problem, but seriously, this is going to be a difficult problem for you to face and for families out there to face who are caught in a very difficult situation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your testimony. Mr. Stewart, you want to briefly address the committee? We had asked if you had wanted to be part of the agenda and you declined, so I'm going to give you just a few minutes here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I guess I'm the exceptional witness this morning that believes that the law on the funding of lawyers for parents in CHIPS cases really is clear. It's not unclear. It's not confusing. There's a statute 260C331 sub 3 that says that the cost of legal representation in these cases is a charge upon the county. So that's the basic law that provides that all the legal representation should be funded by the counties. However, as part of the state takeover that Mr. Tuma referenced, there was an exception carved out, which is that the Board of Public Defense will represent children over 10. That's in 611.14. I think it's pretty clear the counties were supposed to pay for everything. The Board of Public Defense is supposed to represent the children, and we do that. We're very active in representing children in these cases. We're active in serving on the Children's Justice Initiative Advisory Committees around the state. I would suggest to you that it might be appropriate for the counties to have a substantial role in the funding of representation in CHIPS cases. I think it's a good policy because the counties really are kind of the drivers of how the local social service system is going to respond to allegations of abuse or neglect. There are some counties that have put into place tremendous screening and family group conferencing and alternative and diversion tracks. Olmsted County is terrific. Olmsted County is a large county, and they have fewer court filings than many, many smaller counties around the state, because Olmsted County Social Services and the county government says, we're going to take care of these through diversion and family group conferencing before it becomes a filed case with a bunch of lawyers. So the counties have tremendous power about how these cases are handled. And Mr. Chair, I guess I'd leave it at that. We know these are important cases, but we don't have 160 lawyers to devote to 8,000 parent cases. We've been working with the legislature, we've been working with the court system now since about the year 2001 to try to get the funding for this important function.
Thank you, Mr. Stewart, and I'm sure we'll be revisiting this issue again. We have one, real quickly,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stewart, how many of those 8,000 cases actually go to trial?
Mr. Stewart?
In a year? Is that a year figure?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, it's probably about 1% of the 8,000. I think there are the 8,000 CHIPS cases then reduced to a few hundred termination of parental rights cases. And the trial rate is much higher for the termination of parental rights because it's a permanent loss of the children. In the vast majority, after the parents are in court a few times and working with the case plan and so on, they do what they're supposed to do. I mean, I don't want you to think that this is an unsuccessful system, really, because in the majority of cases, the parents do work the case plan. The termination cases, though, do go to trial, and they're very long, complex, difficult trials, lots of expert witnesses. Sometimes they go on for weeks.
Thank you, Mr. Stewart. Susan, would you like to address the committee? We don't have very much time, so if you could keep it to just a couple of minutes.
Thank you. Tim Kinley, president of Our Kids in Minnesota. Have a cable show called Speak to Us in White Bear Lake, deal with family law, judicial oversight issues. Our goal is to see the good parents remain in the lives of the children, and this is one area that has come to us from people calling in. And I just like to say, first of all, I am definitely, and we are definitely in favor of funding for defenders. The only time I hear calls from people, well, first of all, I'd say we really see this as a liberty issue, not a civil issue. We see that the right to marriage and the liberty of marriage and parenting is a fundamental liberty issue, and that's why we would agree with the need for a public defender in these arenas, because when it's being treated as a civil issue, then a lot of these constitutional rights and liberties just get thrown out. And I have people that call and say, look, they said, the police and the workers said, you admit to this or you won't see for your kids for months, and you got to go through all these programs. And they go, but I didn't do anything. And so they're forced to make, without representation, forced to make decisions that affect them for a long time and put a record and give them a record and just messes up their lives seriously. But just to just kind of give you an example of how serious the problem is, Hennepin County Judge James T. Swenson wrote a court order for somebody who was, anyway, I'll just say the court order. The court is troubled when it has to permanently terminate a biological parent's rights, in this case the father, since the mother's deceased. But the court and the legislature have established, and especially when the parent has not been found to be an unfit parent or abandon the child, that the court and legislatures have established the best interest of the child standard, and I'd be abusing my discretion if I awarded the child to the parent. Civil case. Judge admit, didn't do anything wrong. Not unfit. Hasn't abandoned a child. You lose your child. And fortunately, the appellate court ruled with the district court judge. Supreme Court found that, fortunately, overturned that, but he had to go back to another year of court cases. And that's kind of the system we're in, where these liberties turned into civil rights, and then the judges do whatever they want and trample our liberties and take our kids away. So I support public defenders, and so does our kids in Minnesota.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your presentation. Members, we're about out of time. Next Tuesday, we'll be meeting not in the morning, so you can sleep in or do whatever. We will be having a joint hearing with the Public Safety Policy and Oversight Division on the report from the Controlled Substances Working Group on Thursday. Mr. Carter will be giving us a presentation on how to on the governor's recommendations to the agencies that are under the purview of this committee. And we'll also have a report by the Management and Budget Office on the process that we'll be using. And the budget books, I understand, will be ready at this point, and we'll go through those in great detail. So that's the agenda for next week. So thank you, members. This meeting's adjourned.